start off with, I was very anxious and like scared about the future. And then once sort of that seemed like, oh, we're going to be all okay, at least, you know, for the time being, I kind of sort of took this as a time to like take some time off and just like take a rest, really, emotionally and physically.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. During the series, we've heard of the traumatic impact the pandemic has had on the industry. We've also heard of the resilience of those working in the industry and their ability to adapt and evolve. There are also some who have found the seismic shift in their lives has resulted in real positives on their lives. Maria Cabal is the head chef of Tokar Estate in Coldstream, Victoria. Maria, how are you going?
Yeah, good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. What's the state of play at the moment for you? Victoria still hasn't opened up in the CBD. The regional restaurants are allowed to open up. What's the situation that you're in right now?
So we are looking at opening around just after the 20th. I can't remember, was it 22nd and 23rd? Because we have a fair bit of an outdoor area, so we can still sit like 20, 30 people. So our plan is to open around that time, whether that's like, you know, a week's variance or not, we'll see, because it's been very sort of, you know, up and down. We've been promised that, oh, you can open and then you can't, and then you can't do this and you can't do that. So we're very like cautious, but still preparing to open at least for the outdoor dining in a few weeks' time.
With the restrictions that there are, how many people are you able to do in a seating?
Look, I think if it's outdoor only, it probably will be around 20. Normally we can do around 40 people on the deck, but yeah, probably that will be halved. And indoors, when we can, it will be probably around 15, 20 as well. And just, yeah, we'll go from there.
What's it been like in Coldstream? You've had two lockdowns, and what's some of the things that you had to do in regards to getting your income in?
So obviously we had to, you know, close down pretty quickly. So yeah, we've been working on developing our sort of take-home meal boxes offering. And we're going to build from that. So in the beginning, we were quite unsure whether people were going to go for it, because like it seemed like the market was, you know, saturated with everyone trying to survive and trying to make money any way they can. So in the beginning, we're a little bit like scared it's not going to work out. But in the end now, we've built like a really good, like loyal customer base around this area. And like probably like a lot, like I would say 50% of our customers now are like repeat customers, people that have ordered every fortnight. So yeah, we're just doing sort of like take-home meal boxes. That's like four meals for, you know, certain amount of money or whatever. And then there's like that you can get twos, you can get singles or family packs. Yeah, we're just trying to make it, you know, as affordable as possible, but as nice, using, you know, as nice ingredients as we were able to get.
Can you tell us what sort of food you were doing at Tokar before the pandemic, and did you have to change that for a takeaway model?
Oh, we definitely had to change it for the takeaway model. Yes, it just wouldn't travel and it would be hard to sell. So my sort of background is I get really excited about cooking with like secondary and tertiary cuts of meat, and I love a lot of offal, and I've always sort of made it my mission to make people appreciate it more, and like, you know, cook it in a way that people are not shocked or terrified or scared of, like, oh, this is awful, you know. It's always been my sort of my niche. But unfortunately, I don't think I'd be able to sell tongue or sweetbreads or bone marrow for you know, people trying to survive in this area, in era.
So what sort of meals did you do? What's been really successful?
Chicken and beef always goes down a treat. we try to do, you know, like keep it varied, just so we don't get bored ourselves as well. But yeah, look, always when there's there's a beef or a, we've done a few like sort of steak meals. That's always been number one in the popularity list. We do a few like soups as well that people have been like surprised about how much they enjoy having soup, but it always comes with something like on the side, like a cheesy toast or like, you know, some nice smoked tomato soup with a cheesy toasty or something. It's sort of like is more sellable.
A lot of people have talked about the impact of the bushfires before the pandemic and also the challenges that the industry had even before this time. What's the last sort of year or so been like for you?
Yeah, look, definitely very challenging in many ways. I started as head chef at Toka probably around this time last year. It was the end of September. And it was sort of a complete, you know, takeover. I think the old team was completely switched. They, the owners decided to do a bit of like an update of the dining room. So they spent a fair bit of money on renovations. And when I started here, I pretty much had like no team apart from a kitchen hand that I upgraded to an apprentice. And then, you know, it completely had to hire a new team that can be great, but it can also be very challenging because it's hard to find chefs in this area, to be honest. And people don't really want to commute in from the city like I do and like my sous chef now does. And then, you know, we're hoping to get a really nice, like a really good summer season that always, you know, fully packed. And with bushfires, that didn't happen. The valley was like constantly smoky and people didn't want to leave their houses. And it was, yeah, we didn't make the money that we were expecting to make. And then, you know, a few months later, it was COVID. Actually, I had a really bad car accident about 2 weeks before we had to close the restaurant down. So yeah, it's been a year.
What did it feel like at that time? You had a car accident and the pandemic happened. How are you feeling in that period?
Look, for me, it was in a way sort of like a welcomed rest time that I probably wouldn't have been able to take. And to be honest, in the beginning with all of this happening as well, like I was, to start off with, I was very anxious and like scared about the future. But as it, you know, our sort of owners were like very reassuring and saying like, you know, we'll try and take care of as much of the staff as we can, as we possibly are able to, and try to take some of that like anxiety and stress away from us. And then once sort of that seemed like, oh, we're going to be all okay, at least, you know, for the time being, I kind of sort of took this as a time to like take some time off and just like take a rest really. Emotionally and physically.
You don't normally get that working in the hospitality sector, and certainly people through this series have talked about the energy and the drive in the industry, and you don't really have time for a breath. So what has it been like having so much time on your hands, and what impact has it had on you?
I think the first time around when we were in lockdown, I was like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, be real productive and do all the things I normally don't have time to do and like exercise lots and whatever, but I instead ended up drinking way too much and not doing anything. And like now this time around, I'm actually, you know, a bit more like, you know, I don't need to drink 3 bottles of wine by myself every night. I've actually tried to stop drinking altogether for a while. And now I am actually taking on, you know, projects of doing all the stuff that I actually normally wouldn't have time to do in the kitchen because, you know, often you are short-staffed and, like, my HF position is very much involved. Like, I'm in the kitchen all the time doing service with everyone. So having that time to, like, you know, try out things that you've always wanted to do, I've done that in the second lockdown. You know, I've gotten really into making koji and, like, stuff from it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You briefly mentioned your fascination with offal, and you've certainly been making a name for yourself doing that. What is the secret to cooking offal, and why do you have that fascination?
For me, I think I have that fascination because it's what I grew up with. Like we weren't like a very, you know, affluent family, so my parents would always try and find different ways to to cook nice meals, but also that were exciting because they're pretty avid cooks themselves. So yeah, you know, I grew up eating my mom's specialties like roasted pig's tails, for example, and my dad would always make his own pate at home, and you know, lots of Estonian traditional dishes are stuff that's made from offal. And I think if you sort of apply more like modern cooking techniques and maybe like more modern like flavor combinations, you make it sort of like, you know, put a bow on it, basically, I think people would be more inclined to try. But it's hard. It's a hard sell sometimes because everybody's got some idea of, you know, oh, you know, just like imagining offal, it being boiled for a long time with no, you know, no seasoning, no dressing. It's just like a big, you know, tongue or something in your imagination. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, in that sort of realm of secondary cuts and offal, what are some of the things, your favorite things to cook, and how do you do them?
I really love bone marrow, but I mean, that's pretty like I don't know if it is an acquired taste anymore. You see it in menus everywhere, but you know, just put anything on toast. That always works. I find I've done like a duck heart or like a duck liver pate with duck hearts, but just on like again fried cinnamon toast. People like love that. Just anything with bread, I think, is something that is pretty appealing to most people. I mean, just like cooking something for a long time and then just sort of maybe turning into a sauce, or tongue is a really easy one that you can, you know, brine and then cook and then slice really thinly, and that's like comes up really beautiful on a skewer grilled with like a, you know, I don't know, wild garlic dressing because now it's in season and whatever, you know.
You briefly mentioned that you grew up in Estonia, but we don't really see much of the food from Estonia in Australia. Can you paint a picture for us of some of the sort of classic dishes that you grew up with?
So I would say normally like the cuisine is like probably a mixture of everyone that's ever occupied us in all history. Basically, it's either a mixture of Russian, German, Polish, some Scandinavian influences as well, but there'll be a lot of potatoes, a lot of preserving, smoking, drying of fish and meat, a lot of pork. So let's say one of like my favorite things, and this is, I think most Estonian like traditional dishes are something you either have at a wedding or a funeral. Because everything in between is just really like everyday peasant food, like something it's not even worth mentioning and never made it to the history books, you know? But one of my favorite dishes is something similar to like a kind of like a meat jelly, and you have it with horseradish. So it's basically just like all the bits of the pork, you know, the feet, the head, the tails and everything, boiled down for a long period of time with some veggies. And then you pick all the meat and the reduced stock just goes on top, and then just like it's set in these little molds, and you pop it out and you have it with horseradish.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, it's so good. Kind of for people who don't or haven't had anything before, a bit like cat food, but but we love it.
You were selling it really well until that moment.
Yeah, I thought so.
Well, has that influence, does that get on the menus here in Australia? I know that you were with Anata before Toka Estate. Have you snuck sort of Estonian techniques and some stuff from your heritage onto your menus?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we did a dish at Anata that actually sold surprisingly well. It was just like a pork belly, like a roast pork belly with like a blood cake, blood pudding cake, and blood sauce as well. And because obviously you can't really get cranberries or lingonberries here, which are very traditional to have blood pudding with in Estonia, I think I used rye berries, so like an Australian native, but similar flavor profile.
at the top of the show, you mentioned that you're going to be opening around the 22nd of this month. Will the offering change, do you think, because of these circumstances? What are the plans for the restaurant?
So I think the plan is to try and keep on going with our secondary offering, having the Reader's Pantry meals still running in the background. To have, like, I think the main thing is we're trying to make sure we have several streams of income. So if one fails or something is not that great, at least money is always coming in. For the restaurant, I think we are going to be running a limited menu and most probably even a set menu with options. And also, like, you know, I have to think about whether sharing, because, like, our sort of ethos has always been, you know, sharing food and people ordering, you know, different starters just to have, like, in the middle of a table and everyone can try some, whether that's something we can continue encouraging at this time, you know?
There's been a lot of disappointment and anger and frustration and worry in the Melbourne industry because of the second lockdown. How are you feeling about it all and the future of the Victorian hospitality sector, given what it's just been through?
Look, I come from a perspective that I've been extremely fortunate during this time. I've been employed by the same business throughout this whole time. They've supported me 100%. I have had pretty much make no you know, changes to my life apart from the fact that I can't leave my house. But I haven't, I think in a way, maybe, you know, the future is we need a bit of a shake up and maybe, you know, we'll be hopefully be a phoenix that rises from the ashes and make something new, a new normal and new rules. And, you know, people have had different issues with the industry for a long time. And I think maybe this is a chance for us to reset. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
You mentioned that it's been a real blessing in regards to allowing you some space and some time to relax and recoup. Will this experience change you moving forward and the way you operate as a chef?
I think so. I think, and this has been coming from me for a while, to acknowledge that everyone is allowed to have a life outside of work. And if anything, it's important that they do have that. Allowing myself and my staff to, you know, occasionally do take a weekend day off or a weekend off or something. Obviously, that's not the nature of our business and it naturally cannot happen all the time. But it is important to allow for those things to happen and make sure that your worth and, you know, your own worth and your own life isn't just tied to your success at work and everything that happens here.
You mentioned that when you were young, you enjoyed your mum's roasted pig's tails and your dad's pate. What led you to become a chef? What was the inspiration there and how did you get into the industry?
I think I was sort of like quite lost as a young person. And I was just looking for maybe some structure and some sort of like discipline. And I also really enjoyed cooking because that was something that as a family was one of the only things that we really did together. Like even though I love my parents and they're wonderful, you know, they can be a little bit absent sometimes. Like, so, you know, the type of people that just come home, switch on the TV and just like focus on it as zombies for hours and that's their life on repeat. You know, the only thing that we did end up doing together was cooking, and that's the only time everyone is in the kitchen all the time and talking to each other, and that I had like sort of really fond memories and strong connection to food from that. And I think I was just like looking to really, to be honest, get out of Estonia as far as I possibly could. So I was just looking at what the options were at all. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I was like, oh, culinary arts. And that seemed cool. And I was like, I could do that. Didn't know how unprepared I was for this at all. But eventually, I think I did get what I needed from it as a person as well. And yeah, I think it helped me grow tremendously.
And what led you to Melbourne?
So funny enough, when I was finishing high school, it was sort of like a bit of a mass migration of people who are finishing high school that were coming to Australia to do their gap year, the working holiday or whatever. And I was like, oh, I'm never going to Australia. And then moved to did a bit of traveling. Lived in Barcelona for a bit. Lived in London for 4 years. And my friend at the time was living in New Zealand. And you know, I think she was like, "Oh, I'm a bit over Wellington," and I was like, "Oh, I'm a bit over London. You know, need to do something else or go somewhere else." And she's like, "Why don't we move to Melbourne? It's the food capital of the world. You know, like everybody." It's like talking about it and it'd be so great for you. And I was like, sure, maybe I'll come for 6 months. And after 6 months, I realized I'm nowhere ready to leave yet. And 6 years later, here I am.
Well, you are heading towards opening. It's only a couple of weeks away. How has it felt trying to pull the team back together and having that sort of end goal of being able to open the doors again and welcome guests in?
So I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit anxious just because I'm not sure what the new normal is going to look for us. I'm not sure how you know, we can structure menus that makes us happy and keeps us excited, but that will sell and, you know, that are still interesting. I'm not sure how busy we are or how busy we're going to be. I'm hoping that we'll be full, but you never know. And I'm a little bit anxious, and I'm getting when we decided to close, unfortunately, most of our casuals were let go. And there was a lot of casuals in the kitchen at the time. So for us at the moment, it's just myself and my sous chef, who is luckily does, you know, the work of three people. So that's always good, but it shouldn't be like that all the time. So yeah, we are hiring front and back of house.
Well, as we move forward and the restaurant is full again, and you've got all of your kitchen staff back, what are you most looking forward to sort of beyond this sort of period?
I think I'm looking forward to that feeling when you kind of feel a bit, you know, when you've started a new job and you feel a bit settled, like you've got all the systems are in place, everything is working, people know exactly what they're doing, the customers are happy, you have like, you know, few complaints maybe here and there, but they're manageable. No, you know, that sort of feeling when you've really settled, the first feeling you get when you settled into a new job, because I haven't had that yet.
And how are you going to celebrate when you finally get to that sort of stage?
Well, I was actually thinking maybe because I'm turning 30 this year, I was thinking instead of celebrating my birthday now, which is in a couple of weeks away, I might just wait until sort of like around the end of summer and just have a big party for everyone that we work with and all our friends and sort of just be like, we did this, you know? The last year and a half nearly got us, but it didn't quite get us.
Well, that sounds amazing, and hopefully that happens sooner rather than later. Maria, loved having you on Deep in the Weeds. Thank you so much for your time. Please keep in touch, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.